Welcome to The Edge. I'm your host, Tom Smith. Dissatisfaction with election outcomes is a long-standing situation. Why is this? Are there little-known factors that are introducing chaos into apparently orderly elections? Are there solutions we could implement that would correct these faults? Today, our special guests are Rick Klima, who was born in Kingston, New York. He got his bachelor's degree in mathematics at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. At North Carolina State University, he completed his Master of Science in Applied Mathematics in 1994 and his PhD in the same field in 1997, where he actually stayed for a couple years as a full-time visiting instructor in mathematics. In the spring of 1999, he accepted a position as a cryptologic mathematician with the National Security Agency at Fort George Meade, Maryland. And he held this position through the summer of 2000, at which time he re-entered academia by accepting a position as visiting assistant professor of mathematics at the State University of New York at Oswego. His current position is assistant professor of mathematics at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very good. Our next guest is Jonathan Hodge, who got his Bachelor of Science degree in 1998 from Calvin College with honors in mathematics, his Master of Arts in mathematics in 2000 from Western Michigan University, and his PhD from the same university in 2000 in the area of the mathematics of voting theory, and his dissertation title was Separable Preference Orders. He is currently assistant professor of mathematics at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. Welcome, John.
Hi, Tom.
Well, today we're going, both of you have written this very good book that's published by the American Mathematical Society called The Mathematics of Voting and Elections, A Hands-On Approach. And this book I've read parts of this book here, and I can say that you don't have to have any advanced mathematics. High school level is fine, where you could read this book and understand it. And the material we're going to discuss today is actually covered from this book. And I guess I'll turn it over to you, gentlemen.
Turned out really good, we think, and it was a lot of fun to write. We had no idea when we started what all we would get into. And the more we studied the subject of voting theory, the more controversy we discovered, the more counterintuitive ideas that we discovered, and like you said, it doesn't require any advanced mathematics. We wrote it with the intention that it could be used in high school curriculum, something that students might find interesting. So, and because we want it to be interesting for students, it's not just politically based, it's popular culture based. You know, elections don't just happen in the political world. They happen in the world of sports, they happen in the world of entertainment, many countless areas.
Well, and actually privately as well, colleges have elections, they also have corporations have them for board of certain positions. You know, sometimes in hiring, voting is used in hiring,
right,
as well. Yeah.
Yeah, we're exposed to these sorts of things every day, and I got introduced to the field of voting theory as an undergraduate, did my senior thesis in voting theory, and since then have just fallen in love with the field. And so when I came to Grand Valley, there was an opportunity to create a course, an upper-level general education course designed for non-mathematics majors, and this seemed like the perfect context to do it in. So it was a real fun experience. We wrote the book so that it would be applicable to a broad audience, and we've been pretty pleased with how it's worked out.
Yeah.
And my interest in voting theory is probably more like what your listeners are. It's just recreational. I just find it interesting that, you know, so many perplexing things happen in elections. And there was really a renewed interest in that kind of thing, the perplexing things that can happen in elections. In the 2000 presidential election, when for the first time in a long time, the winner of the election, George W. Bush, did not receive the largest number of votes, mm-hmm. Unquestionably received many fewer votes than Al Gore, 500,000 or something,
mm-hmm.
and yet George W. Bush was able to win that election because, as you know, we use the Electoral College, not a count the votes and see who has the most sort of thing for presidential elections.
Mm-hmm.
And while we all knew that was true, we hadn't been slapped in the face with it until for a while, until 2000.
Yeah.
And so my interest began then as recreationally as was the case for many people,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, the 2000 presidential election is a great example. In many ways, it did bring this renewed interest in voting theory, and also demonstrated some of the misunderstandings that people have about the Electoral College. And there was a lot of talk in the media about Bush not legitimately winning the election because he hadn't won the popular vote. And the problem with that is that had the election been based on the popular vote, it just wouldn't have been the same election. You know,
yeah.
Campaigns would have been run differently, voter turnout would have been different, and so on. So it's important when we look at these systems to realize that not only do they govern the outcome of the election, but they also determine in a significant way just about everything else that occurs in the weeks and months leading up to the election.
Yes.
So it's perhaps not fair to say that Bush was not the legitimate winner because he would have lost under a different set of rules. We have to look at what rules were in place on Election Day, and those were the rules set forth in the Constitution when the Electoral College was established.
Yes.
Right, and John, that's a real good point. Like, for example, many people did not turn out to vote in the 2000 presidential election from Texas because it was clear that Bush was going to carry that state. Why did they need to bother going? You know, if Bush won by 20 million or 2 in Texas, he wins the same number of electoral votes. Now, the same thing's probably true in California. A lot of people stayed home who would have voted for Gore because it was obvious Gore was going to carry California in 2000. So, right, if it was held just a regular count the votes and see who wins election in 2000, we might have expected a greatly different turnout.
Yeah, and it'd be quite hard to predict exactly what the outcome would have been because of all the different factors that would go into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
and ultimately the controversy wasn't there because in 2000, although Gore had 500,000 or so more votes than Bush, he did not have more than half. Which is something that's only happened once in U.S. presidential elections. It's been a long time since it happened. It was 1876, when actually we had a loser of a U.S. presidential election who actually received more than half of the popular votes. Then there's some controversy, certainly more than in 2000. The controversy in 2000 wasn't interpreting the number of votes. It was actually counting the votes, for instance, in Florida, when there was some controversy about votes being thrown away, because ultimately the race in Florida was so close. Less than 0.01% of the voters separated Bush from Gore and the 25 electoral votes in Florida.
Yeah, the 1876 election is very interesting because, like the 2000 election, it was decided by one electoral vote. The totals were 185 to Hayes versus 184 to Tilden.
Right.
And that was in spite of the fact that Tilden received nearly 51% of the popular vote compared to Hayes's 48%.
Mm-hmm.
We almost had a situation like this happen in 2004 also in the state of Ohio. Had the outcome of the election gone the other way, gone to Kerry by around 60,000 votes more for Kerry, we would have had Ohio go to Kerry, therefore the presidential election would have gone to Kerry, and Bush still would have received a majority of the popular vote nationwide, but he would have lost the election. So we came fairly close to a rather historic election back in 2004.
Yeah.
I don't know. Have you had a chance? I don't know how much of our book you've had a chance to read. Did you have a chance to read the chapter on apportionment?
Yes, that is very interesting. There's several different methods, and I know that George Washington rejected a certain apportionment method. First of all, let's explain to our listeners what apportionment is.
Apportionment is basically the process of doling out seats in the House of Representatives to the states. The problem with that is we have a fixed number of seats in the House, 435, I think, and every state based on its population, how much of the entire United States population lives in that state, they deserve an exact number of seats. That exact number of seats includes a decimal part. The problem is we can't give a decimal part of the seat away. Everyone has to get a whole number of seats.
Yep.
And that's the apportionment problem. Figure out exactly how many whole number of seats each state is going to get based on what it deserves, which is a number that includes a decimal part.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we tried to do in the book, now we only have one chapter on apportionment because it technically is not an election, but we thought it should be there, a chapter on apportionment, because there are so many issues that connect apportionment with elections. Like, for example, and this is what made me think of that election from 1876, that went in favor of Hayes over Tilden, was actually based upon an unconstitutional apportionment. We reapportion the seats in the House every 10 years,
mm-hmm.
On the twos, so 1872 was the last apportionment before that election of 1876. The apportionment that year was not done by any method that is approved by the Constitution. And that unconstitutional apportionment actually cost Tilden the election. If we had used any method, then the seats in the House would have been such that Tilden would have easily won that election.
Interesting.
There's a reason why the Constitution is written the way it is. There's a reason why things are allowed and not allowed. And when we don't follow the Constitution, bad things can happen.
Yes.
Which that was especially bad for Tilden. And this is a reason why ultimately there was no controversy in 2000. We did what the Constitution told us to do. And if
yeah.
we stop doing what the Constitution says to do, then we run into problems like 1876.
Yes, indeed.
And even with apportionment, though, the Constitution doesn't specify exactly how the seats of the House need to be apportioned. And so that's been the debate over the centuries, is how exactly are we going to essentially complete this problem of rounding a bunch of numbers so that we give away exactly the right number of seats. And that's where a lot of rather famous historical figures have entered into the picture, folks like Webster, Hamilton, Jefferson, and there's been a lot of debate about which apportionment methods are best and why.
Yeah. So the current type of apportionment that's being used right now, what effect does that have?
So the current method that we use is a method that was proposed by Joseph Hill, the chief statistician of the Census Bureau, back in the early 1900s.
Okay.
And there's an interesting story behind that. Hill's method is one of two methods, Hill's and Webster's method, which was created by Daniel Webster. Hill's and Webster's methods are the two methods that most people that study apportionment in detail, whether they're political scientists or mathematicians or whatever, almost all of them endorse one of those two as being the best method. And most, actually, more than Hill's method, more people support Webster's method as being the correct method, the best method, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the method that we use. We don't use Daniel Webster's method. We use Joseph Hill's method. And the reason is, now they're very similar, and sometimes they give identical number of seats, but one time in 1941 they did not. There was one seat difference between Hill's method and Webster's method. That one seat would have, under Hill's method, gone to Arkansas. Under Webster's method, would have gone to Michigan. Michigan being a Republican state at the time and Arkansas being a Democratic state at the time, the vote in Congress split exactly along party lines. Every Democrat voting for Hill's method, every Republican voting for Webster's.
Isn't that interesting?
And the Democrats had control of Congress, and the Democrats had the White House at the time, Franklin Roosevelt. And so it passed through Congress, it passed through the White House, and we use it to this day. They signed it into permanent law at that time, which just means they need a law to reverse it. But we use it to this day based all on the fact that in 1942, I guess the apportionment of 1942, Hill's method gave an extra seat to a Democratic state.
Interesting. So what effect does this have as far as power that the different states have? Do some states have more power from this apportionment than others?
Well, Hill's method is slightly in the favor of smaller states, although our apportionment just is actually based upon, is designed to be a little bit in favor of smaller states, just based upon the fact that every state is guaranteed to have one representative.
Yes.
No matter how small of a number of seats they deserve exactly, every state gets one at least. And that actually, interestingly enough, has an effect upon presidential elections. Back in the, speaking again of the 2000 presidential election, the fact that smaller states, ones that are very small, are treated unfairly in their favor by being granted a full seat even when they deserve just a very small portion of one, and smaller states which voted more in favor of Bush than Gore in 2000, is one reason why Bush ended up winning that election. I can't remember who the authors were of an article that I read in, I can't even remember where I read it now, but they did an analysis of the outcome of the 2000 presidential election based on various House sizes. If the House was increased in size, that takes a little bit of that extra power away from the smaller states because they still just get their one seat. As we increase the size of the House, how much the smaller states deserve goes up, but if they still just get their one. Well, there was a cutoff somewhere where every size for the House larger than this cutoff, and it wasn't unreasonable, maybe 600 or something, every size House larger than that, and Gore would have won that election. And every size House smaller than a certain number, Bush would have won the election.
Yeah.
So, by the way, that size of the House, which is now fixed by law at 435, you know, has not increased proportionally with the population of the United States. Overall, right now, I think we have the smallest number of people per representative than we've ever had.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about the way the Electoral College is set up as well is not only do the small states get the boost from having a guaranteed seat in the House of Representatives, but they also have two guaranteed seats in the Senate, regardless of their population. Mm-hmm. So even the smallest states have three electoral votes. Now, on the surface, it looks like that means the smaller states would be more powerful. But on the flip side of that, the larger states, such as California carrying 55 electoral votes, are much more likely to be necessary for a candidate to win an election. So in that regard, you could argue that the larger states really do have more power.
Yes. And California does have, in actuality, more power than it has population.
Right.
From a proportional standpoint, yes. And,
okay.
I mean, this gets into another very interesting facet of voting theory, and that's how do we measure the power of different players in a political system? And there's a lot of fairly sophisticated mathematics behind all of that. But, for instance, one measure of the power of the U.S. president in the U.S. federal system gives him 0.4% of the total power. Another measure gives him 77% of the total power. And so you can see that these results are very much dependent on exactly which methods we're using to do the calculations and which assumptions we're bringing into those calculations.
Yes, in other words, how we're defining power, what kind of power we're talking about.
Yeah, and power ultimately being based on a voter's ability to affect the outcome of an election.
Yeah.
Like, for example, in the 2000 presidential election. Yes, Wyoming, being the smallest, least populated state, has much less power in the Electoral College than California does, with 55 electoral votes now. But the fact is, Wyoming, if Wyoming had gone for Gore instead of Bush in 2000, Gore would have won that election.
Interesting.
So Wyoming, although they have very smaller number of electoral votes than California, they at least have some power there because they can affect the outcome of an election.
Interesting. Now, there's something else which is a major factor in outcomes of elections, and that's the voting method that's used by voters, which is determined by statute. That's that voting method. Could you tell us about that, please?
Well, I mean, let's start with the simplest case.
Okay.
Because this is a real good question, and the question is, how do we evaluate which voting methods are best, and are we using the best methods now? So if we start with the very simplest case, an election with only two candidates, if I asked you, Tom, what do you think the method we should use to decide, say, a mayoral race between two candidates would be, what would your first gut instinct be?
Well, it would probably be like a majority voting. In other words, whichever candidate gets the majority, we're talking two candidates here, whichever candidate gets the majority then would get the office.
Right, and that's, I mean, that's going to be the response of most people you'd ask that question. But now, we could ask ourselves, what's so good about majority rule? That's actually where we start the book, right?
Yep.
Chapter one. And yep. As it turns out, as we might expect, majority rule satisfies some very important properties. I mean, one of those properties might be that it treats all of the voters equally. Another property, that it treats all of the candidates equally.
Yep.
And finally, with majority rule, receiving more votes actually helps you, which is what we'd want, of course, instead of harming you. So you have three important properties there. And as it turns out, when we look at those properties, majority rule is the only voting system that satisfies those properties and avoids the possibility of ties. And that's a famous result known as Mays' theorem.
Yeah.
And so there's actually, though, other systems that come relatively close to that, systems that we would not consider very good at all. For instance, a dictatorship, which most of us probably would not think is very democratic. A dictatorship does treat all of the candidates equally. The dictator can vote for whoever he wants, and that candidate will become the winner of the election. And if everybody gives a voter more votes, if the dictator gives the voter more votes or gives a candidate more votes, that candidate will only do better. So it satisfies two of the three important properties that that majority rule would. And so does imposed rule satisfies two of the three properties. And minority rule satisfies two of the three properties as well. But when we're looking at good voting systems, we have this nice result that says majority rule is the only one that satisfies all three properties.
Right, and so the end of it all for two candidate elections is we use majority rule and that's it. The problem comes in when there's not just two candidates. And the problem comes in that there's not just one way to evaluate the votes of voters, even if there was just two candidates. You know, like, for instance, we use the Electoral College to decide the presidency. Therefore, it is possible for someone to, in a presidential election, receive more than half the votes who would be a majority rule winner and yet not win the election, because we don't use that majority rule for presidential elections.
And that's a really good point that Rick's just made. In fact, the Electoral College, if we view the voters as individual voters in their respective home states, the Electoral College doesn't satisfy the property of anonymity, which is the property of treating all of the voters equally. It's, for instance, trading a vote. If somebody in Wyoming trades a vote with somebody in California, that can affect the outcome of the election. And so those two voters are treated differently by the Electoral College.
Yes, yes.
So now, we go into detail in the book about how this presence of additional candidates beyond the first two can have wild effects on an outcome, like Ralph Nader had in 2000, when it really can't be denied. If Ralph Nader's not there, Gore wins that election. And on a smaller scale, Ross Perot in 1992. But it's when we have a presence of a third major candidate is when things really start to get screwed up in elections.
Yeah.
And you can get bizarre things like Jesse Ventura being elected governor of Minnesota. That would not have happened if there were just two candidates in that election. If it was Jesse Ventura against anybody else, he would have lost. But because there were three major candidates, Ventura and then a Republican and a Democrat who split votes, Ventura was able to win that election. Win that election where, you know, exit polling indicated that at least 60% of people voting preferred Ventura the least. And yet he was able to win that election because it was an election with more than two candidates. An election that was held under plurality, the method of whoever gets the largest number of votes wins. It just so happened that Ventura's 37% of the votes, it's likely that most of the other 63% of the people would have preferred him the least.
Yeah. Now,
we look at, for example, the California recall election in 2003.
Yeah.
There were 135 different candidates listed on the ballot in the event that Governor Davis was recalled, which, of course, we know he was. And, I mean, if you think about that, with that many candidates, theoretically speaking, the winner could have received less than 1% of the total vote. And he could have, in fact, been the last choice of the other 99% of the voters.
Yeah.
And that's just a consequence of the fact that the plurality system is used to determine that election and most other elections.
Right. So
I guess while that's not likely that that would be the case, with a smaller number of candidates, it is not just possible, but it happened in Minnesota. We had three candidates, and someone won with just over one-third of the votes.
Yeah.
And in a case where just under two-thirds of the voters likely would have preferred that candidate the least.
Yeah.
So it's not just possible, it happens.
Yeah, and there are other systems. Now plurality voting just kind of looks at a person's maybe like first place, in some cases anyway, if they're voting sincerely, their first place score, but it doesn't look at secondary or tertiary preferences, and there are systems that do. Am I correct?
Yes, right, of course, and that's right. That's how Ventura ended up winning that election, because we didn't care who the second place candidate was. We didn't care who the third place candidate was. On the ballots, we only cared who the first place candidate was.
And if we had used any other voting system in that election that did take into account those second and third place choices, it's any other reasonable system, it's pretty certain that Ventura would have lost.
Right. Any other system, like, for example, a point system where you assign points where the voters rank the candidates 1, 2, 3, or however many there are. And we, for instance, could assign points to each candidate on each ballot. That's the system that's used to do most college polling, like the football polls and basketball polls. They're not ranked by first place votes. They're ranked by number of points that they receive, and they use what's called a board account voting system,
mm-hmm.
where points are assigned. Then there's also runoff methods where you eliminate candidates maybe one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, the voting system that is used on the TV show Survivor is a variation of that. We eliminate one candidate at a time if we view the players in that system on the game as the candidates. They're being eliminated one at a time based upon the result of a vote.
Okay.
And that's a variation of Coombs' voting method is what they use on Survivor. And I think also American Idol eliminates one candidate at a time, although a difference there, I think, is the voters in that case, who are the people that watch the show and call in, vote for who they want to stay, versus Survivor, the voters who are actually the people on the show, they're voting for who they want to leave.
Yeah.
But those are both eliminate one candidate at a time type methods.
Yeah. Gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break here for some public service announcements. We're going to be back after this break, again with Richard Klima and Jonathan Hodge, with more on voting and elections.
You are listening to Hawk Radio, the number one college radio station streaming on the net.
Hawk Radio is proud to be a member of the Broadcast Education Association. Hawk Radio has been a member of the BEA since 1998. The Broadcast Education Association is the professional development organization for professors, college, university, and professionals involved in educating and training students to work in television, radio, and electronic media industry. Hawk Radio, training future broadcasters today.
1, 2, 3. Dennis plays the kind of music that I like. He just
shouldn't
sing along with it.
Oh, yeah. I do that so other people don't get it. You know?
Exactly.
It's the only karaoke station in town. You know, nobody else does it. And when I tell you to do that, you know, like I always tell you to keep two hands on the wheel, you know, because like if you start clapping and singing along with the songs I play, man, you're going to wind up in a ditch somewhere.
He can play whatever he wants. He can sing. He doesn't have to promise not to.
All right.
Listen to Hail Hawk Rock and Roll. Sing and dance at your own risk. You're enjoying Hawk Radio. Hawk Radio can be heard on the net at www.hawkradio.com 24 hours a day. Listen at home or in your office. Our email address is dj@hawkradio.com or give us a call, area code 813-253-7592.
Hawk Radio.
And we're back with our guests today, Jonathan Hodge and Richard Klemer, who are both mathematicians who wrote the book, The Mathematics of Voting in Elections, which is published by the American Mathematical Society. You can actually get a copy of this book by going to the website AMS, www.ams.org, and they have a book ordering links. You can follow those. This book is it's a paperback. It's over 200 pages. It's asks a lot of questions so that the reader can start thinking for themselves and actually looking at what they've actually applying what they've learned. And it covers many, many different topics. You don't need to be have a PhD in math to understand it, just high school level. It's very good if you want to be an educated citizen, and it's today it's more important than ever to be an educated citizen. I would recommend that you purchase and read this book. Now, we were talking about, before we went to break, we were talking about voting methods. So let's go back into that.
Yeah, I think we left off with runoff methods and the board account. The board account being the method used in like college polls where points are assigned to each candidate on each ballot. And then the candidates are ranked not by number of first place votes they receive, but by the number of points that they receive. And so we can have what happens occasionally, that a team in a college basketball or football poll is ranked first, even though somebody else got a larger number of first place votes. The team ranked first is the one, of course, with the largest number of points.
Okay.
And then the runoff method, the runoff methods like used on Survivor, like used on American Idol, like is also a runoff type method is used by the International Olympic Committee to select cities to host the Olympics, which was recently in the news, London beating, winning out over Paris for the to host the 2012 Olympics. And that, of course, you know, wasn't just London against Paris. It was London against four other cities, a total of five, and the IOC holds votes and eliminates one city at a time. The criteria they use for elimination is the smallest number of votes. They vote for one city. The one with the smallest number of votes is eliminated, and the next, then four cities are left. They move on, and then they repeat the procedure until there's just one city left.
Okay. Now, in a board account, there's different rankings. Let's say you have, for example, four candidates in an election. Then there's basically four rankings at that point. And when you support a candidate, when you vote, if you vote to support a candidate, that vote is reflected in the tallies. In other words, they would increase in the tallies.
Mm-hmm.
But in instant runoff voting,
uh-huh,
if you vote to support a candidate, it doesn't necessarily help them. It can harm them. Am I correct?
Well, in some cases, that's true. Now, instant runoff voting is a version of runoff, of a normal runoff election, except that the word instant in there means that everyone registers their full preferences, and the runoff is done based on those same ballots automatically, so we don't actually re-vote. And it's a system that's promoted by a lot of organizations, and it's used in some pretty high-profile elections. Like, it's used to elect the President of Ireland and the Mayor of London and members of the Australian House of Representatives.
Yep.
But you're right, it violates this fundamental property of monotonicity. A voter can actually hurt a candidate by ranking them higher on their ballot, and this seems really perverse.
Yes.
The funny thing about instant runoff voting, though, is that when it was proposed by Thomas Hare in the 1800s, one of his friends, philosopher John Stuart Mill, was just very pleased with his system, talked about its perfect feasibility and its transcendent advantages. He went on to say that in his conviction, those qualities placed Mr. Hare's plan among the very greatest improvements yet made in the theory and practice of government.
Oh, my.
And in spite of this, we have a system that violates monotonicity. It can hurt a candidate to rank them higher on your ballot, and it also violates the Condorcet winner criterion, meaning it it can fail to elect a candidate who would beat every other candidate in a head-to-head contest, though that's a criterion that many would argue is not as important or serious as the violation of monotonicity.
Yes. Yes. In fact, I think by many election, well, perhaps most election theorists, neutrality, anonymity, and monotonicity are fundamental for any election method to be a starter at all.
Yes, and you could argue that one reason the Condorcet winner criterion might not be as important is, well, for instance, we could have a candidate that was in fact ranked first by a majority of voters, as is often the case or sometimes the case in these sports polls, but that candidate could also be ranked last, say, by everyone else, so ranked first by 51% of the voters and ranked last by 49% of the voters, that candidate would be a Condorcet winner, but it might not be reasonable to select that candidate, because there might be another candidate, say one who is ranked second by everyone, who would be a better compromise.
Yeah, so the board account method of voting would actually be more of a consensus type system rather than a majoritarian type system. Am I correct?
Yeah, to some extent, and the board account also has a number of desirable mathematical properties that in my view make it a better system than instant runoff voting.
Right, desirable enough that even though it's possible under the board account for the majority criterion to be violated, it's possible for a candidate to be ranked first by a majority of the voters and yet still lose, that we don't worry about that so much because it has so many other good qualities. Like John said, you can be ranked first by 51% and have a majority vote you first, and yet there's somebody else that's ranked first or second by everybody who would obviously be a better choice.
Yes, yes. So on a board account, you're less likely to elect a controversial, divisive candidate than, let's say, with plurality voting.
Yeah, but it's right. But it still does have some problems. As it turns out, if we're going to try to find a method that doesn't have any problems at all, then we're in trouble.
Yeah.
So it does have some problems, but its problems aren't maybe as bad as the bad things that go along with some other methods. And hopefully we'll have time to get into that in a little while, the fact that every single method at least has something wrong with it.
Yes.
Right, and in fact, that statement that Rick just made about every single method has something wrong with it, that's probably one of the most celebrated or mourned results in all of voting theory, depending on your perspective. It won Kenneth Arrow a Nobel Prize, something that he proved in 1951. Arrow's impossibility theorem is certainly a huge and significant result in the field. It's also one that's very misunderstood because it says some very specific things.
Although that's a little bit of a vague statement to say every voting system has something bad about it, because that depends on what you view as bad.
Right, and that's exactly where the confusion with Arrow's theorem comes in. Because Arrow had five very specific conditions that he thought voting systems should satisfy. And if the conditions we think voting systems should satisfy are different from Arrow's, well, then we're working within a different framework. I mean, some of these conditions are ones that we would not argue with at all. For instance, the system shouldn't be a dictatorship. It shouldn't be equivalent to imposed rule. And like you were talking about earlier, Tom, a reasonable voting system should be monotone.
Yeah.
But one of Arrow's conditions talked about a system being independent of irrelevant alternatives. In other words, it shouldn't be influenced by, essentially, third-party candidates who don't have a chance of winning the election.
Yeah.
And Arrow's formulation of that condition was fairly strict and specific. And what we find is actually that if we weaken that condition slightly, the board account satisfies all of Arrow's conditions with this modified condition in place of the independence of irrelevant alternatives condition. So a lot of what we think about as being the search for a perfect voting system depends very much on how we define what a perfect voting system is.
Yeah, so there are voting systems. Some voting systems are better for certain circumstances than others.
Right,
and just to clarify for your listeners, this independence of irrelevant alternatives criterion. The candidates in question aren't always completely irrelevant, and we see examples of that frequently, like the 2000 presidential election, in which case Nader could in some sense be viewed as irrelevant. He had no chance of winning the election, but he did have an effect upon the winner. Without Nader in that race, Gore beats Bush. Nader's present, and Bush beats Gore.
Yeah.
And it's not just a political thing. We hear about that frequently in rankings as well. Like, for instance, one example that I like to use is in figure skating. There was, in the 2002 Winter Olympics, there was some controversy surrounding the figure skating competitions. There was the controversy surrounding the French judge who was pressured into voting a particular way. But then there was a controversy outside of that in the final medals for the women's competition. Before the final woman competitor skated, Michelle Kwan was in line for the gold, Sarah Hughes in line for the silver. Then the final competitor skated, Michelle Kwan dropped all the way to the bronze, and Sarah Hughes was given the gold. The independence of a relevant alternatives criterion says that shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen that if Kwan is ahead of Hughes and somebody else goes, it shouldn't flip-flop them. It shouldn't drop Kwan below Hughes.
Yes.
And that's what happened.
Right, because both Kwan and Hughes were done skating.
They had already gone and finished.
From that perspective, the preference between them should have been fixed, and that's what Arrow would say.
Yes.
And if that last competitor had just decided not to skate, Kwan would have gotten the gold. Instead, the final competitor skates, and Hughes gets the gold. That shouldn't happen. That's what Arrow said shouldn't happen.
Yes.
But there's lots of other ways of kind of capturing that notion of independence of irrelevant candidates that are perhaps not quite so strong as the condition Arrow used.
Okay. Let's get more into the area of referenda. And just before we go into that, I just want to clarify something on dictatorships. Let's say you have a committee of people and they're just voting on different issues, and let's say this committee has four people, four voting members there, and each are two vote for, two vote against. But somebody at some point in time made some kind of bylaw, some kind of rule, that in the event of a tie, the chairman, who normally does not vote, he just conducts the meeting, he or she conducts the meeting, casts a tie-breaking vote. Would that be like a dictatorship?
Sounds strangely like the Senate, doesn't it, Tom?
Yeah.
Oh, that's an interesting illusion there. But I don't think in that situation we would consider that tie-breaking voter a dictator according to how dictator is usually defined.
Yes.
Because his power is somewhat limited. In a dictatorship, there is a voter who can, regardless of circumstances, force his or her preference on the rest of the electorate.
Yep. Okay. So... But in that case, how those people voted would be completely irrelevant. It would just be up to one person.
Right, but not in every instance.
Right. Okay. All right,
and
fair enough.
Those votes were relevant in the sense that they set up the tie that necessitated the vote from the tiebreaker.
Okay. Right. Okay. Let's say a committee study is done to confirm theories of why glaciers are melting away in North America. Say there are six theories that are presented, and these theories are not mutually exclusive. So committee members can vote to support more than one. Now, the result of any study can confirm the theories, they can disconfirm the theories, or where the evidence is inconclusive, the choice would be uncertain. So in any investigation, there are three possible outcomes, which is confirm, disconfirm, or uncertain. If the voting method employed by this particular committee only allowed two choices, confirm and disconfirm, could that allow insincere voting?
Well, let me try to process all of that. that allow insincere voting.
In other words,
voting to disconfirm when they really are not opposed to it.
Right. So you're pinning people into choosing between two options that neither of which they might agree with.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in some sense, no matter how somebody voted, they would be potentially insincere in one regard or another.
Okay.
So are you leading into approval voting, which is a method that we haven't mentioned yet, a method that is endorsed by many people that have studied voting theory in great detail?
Okay.
Okay. Where voters actually vote for each candidate in an election, they vote to either approve or disapprove of that candidate with no middle ground there. You have to either approve or disapprove of everyone. And then the candidate with the largest number of approval votes wins that election.
Okay. Now, in the case where you have three possible outcomes, what I mentioned there, the confirm, disconfirm, and the uncertain, but only confirm and disconfirm were allowed, would that be a neutral voting method?
That be a neutral voting method. I suppose that depends on what you mean by neutral here. In terms of neutral, we often think about a neutral method as being one that treats all of the candidates equally.
Okay.
So I'm not sure how that
particular
criterion applies to this particular system that you have mentioned.
Or you could view it as there's many ways you could apply that same criterion to that system.
Okay. Now, if this committee, if all these, this all came to a vote, and if the committee were to vote simultaneously on all six theories, what could occur?
So now I think you're talking about a situation where conceivably a voter's preference on one of the proposals could depend on the outcome of the other proposals. And that's a situation actually that happens in referendum elections all the time.
Okay.
And that causes a number of rather strange and perverse outcomes.
Like you would want the first proposal to be confirmed only if the second proposal was not confirmed.
And when you have preferences like that, I mean, you can have really strange election outcomes, like a situation where the winning outcome of the election is actually the last choice of every single voter. And that seems really perverse. We say, how could that happen? Well, it happens because of interdependencies between your preferences on the different proposals and the fact that you're forced to vote on those proposals simultaneously.
Okay. All right. So what you're going to get an outcome which, let's say, a social outcome, a societal outcome, which is very different from the outcome that most voters, a preferred outcome of most voters.
John, I know that you're doing some research in that area right now. I mean, so a natural question to ask is, it is possible for in a referendum election for the outcome to be the last choice of every voter, but how likely? Is that something that would never happen in reality, or is it something that could happen or does happen?
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting question. That's something that I've actually been studying this summer with one of the undergraduate students who worked with us on the book. We've been doing a research project this summer. And unfortunately, it seems that these types of strange and perverse outcomes are actually more common than we would want them to be. We've been running some simulations, and for instance, we had one of those outcomes where the winning outcome was the last choice of every single voter in a simulation of only 200 elections just the other day. So 200 elections, if you think about how many referendum elections are run in this country or even in any given state or municipality in any given year, The likelihood of these sorts of outcomes is alarmingly high.
Yeah. I think I read somewhere where there was a referendum conducted in California, and there was like 26 different referenda, 26 different issues on the ballot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the outcome of the election, if you were to look at it and look at what the actual individual ballots, how they were cast on this referenda, you would find that not one voter supported that outcome.
Right, and that would have been true probably of just about any outcome that could have been selected, simply because of the sheer number of outcomes that are possible, and that dwarfs the number of the number of voters that there are. So, yeah, you certainly have situations where essentially no one agrees with the outcome of the election on every issue,
yeah.
And you might have people who disagree with the outcome of the election on many of the issues. And especially when you have that many issues on the same ballot, you're really just asking for trouble there, because these types of interdependent preferences that cause all the problems, another recent result is that these are extremely common, and as the number of questions in the election increases, the chance of having these interdependent preferences goes to almost 100% and goes there very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so with 26 proposals on the ballot, that's a ridiculously high number of proposals to expect any kind of sense to be made out of the outcome.
Okay, now let's go back to this committee that's studying the melting glaciers here. If the committee were to vote sequentially on all these six theories, in other words, they were to vote on one theory, then the vote be announced, and vote on another one, that vote announced, would that be different than voting that the committee voted simultaneously?
Well, that would certainly give voters the ability to, if they would approve Proposal 2 only if they would confirm the second proposal, if the first one was rejected, then that would give them the ability to reflect that in their voting, which they couldn't do originally.
Strangely enough, though, some recent research has also shown that while the outcome of a sequential system like that might be different, sometimes it's even worse than the outcome that would have been produced by simultaneous voting, which is a very counterintuitive result. You'd think if you supply voters with this additional information and let them make decisions one stage at a time, that would always produce a better outcome. But in fact, that's not always the case. And there's really only one circumstance where that sort of sequencing has been shown to produce outcomes that are at least as good as the outcomes of simultaneous voting, and that's if we sequence off just one question at the very end. So vote on, if we had, say, these 26 propositions on the ballot, vote on the first 25 altogether and then vote on one at the end, and that's guaranteed to at least not do any worse than simultaneous voting would have done.
Plus, you've got the extra problem thrown in there that if there's a large number of voters, it might not be feasible to run an have the election broken up into several pieces.
Yeah.
It's just so much easier to vote on all the proposals at the same time as opposed to splitting that vote up, having to vote, see what the result is, then vote again.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly easier now where we can vote on the internet, but
yeah.
It's not as easy as just voting on everything at once.
Unfortunately, I think, though, that there's some cause for optimism here. We talk about all these awful things happening with referendum elections, but the good news is that this problem has only been studied in the context of referendum elections for a relatively short period of time. I mean, the first papers on this appeared in the mid to late 90s, so there's still a lot of work to be done, and I think there's some indications that there are some rather reasonable ways to avoid some of these difficulties.
Okay, if we could control these elections and nobody would say this or that's impractical, what would be the optimum way to vote on referenda?
I think that's still an open question.
Don't know the answer.
Okay.
If you have an answer to that, then you should write a paper, because that's what myself and other researchers are looking into right now, is how exactly should we vote to get around some of these difficulties.
Okay, but we know that the simultaneous voting, and we know that the sole site simultaneous and the sole sequential have some paradoxical results.
Sure, they do. My suspicion, given what we know about the rest of voting theory, is that virtually every method we could come up with would be open to some of these paradoxical results. So
that's not unreasonable to suspect, because we, as it turns out, Kenneth Arrow showed that true for non-referenda elections with more than two candidates. every system is capable of producing something that is counterintuitive to what we would expect in democracy.
Yeah, but I think that in light of that, the question we can ask is, given the circumstances that we have, given the type of election we're looking at, which system is going to be, first of all, practical to implement and least likely to produce some of the unfair or paradoxical outcomes that we would like to avoid?
That's a good point, practical to implement. Of course, we know that the board account is a better system than plurality in some sense. But can you imagine trying to you know, it, board account requires a ranked ballot. Can you imagine, like, for instance, in the California governor recall election, ranking 135 candidates?
That would definitely be impractical.
We could reasonably expect the voters.
No, and I just wouldn't have been able to decide between Gary Coleman and Larry Flynt. I mean, how do you rank them?
Gentlemen, we're running out of time. I'd like to have you folks back real soon because, really, we need more time to go into a number of these topics in just 1 hour.
I agree.
And but I appreciate your being on the program today, taking your time out to be on this program. Today we've had on Richard Klima and Jonathan Hodge, who wrote the book The Mathematics of Voting in Elections, A Hands-On Approach, which is published by the American Mathematical Society. You can get it, this book, at www.ams.org, and you just follow the links there. It's a paperback. It's a little over 200 pages. It all requires is high school mathematics level. I recommend it for responsible citizenship. That's it for this week's The Edge. I'm your host, Tom Smith. We'll be back again next week with another interesting guest. Bye-bye.